everyone. Hope you had a good weekend. Welcome back. I'm Henrik, and we're glad to have you with us for another episode. If you're new to the program, please take a look at the websites, redicecreations.com and redicecreations.net, and keep up with our latest updates on all the topics that concerns us the most, that is of utmost importance. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast feed, the radio show. We also have a news feed, and we also produce videos that you can take a look at. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. You can also catch the radio show, the first hour, on YouTube, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and on TuneIn as well. Our guest is Dan Root. He was born in Springs, east of Johannesburg in South Africa. He studied Afrikaans, French, comparative literature at the University of Witwatersrand, as well as philosophy at the University of Paris 8. He published a short novel and a book of poetry at the age of 23. Since then, he's written 23 books, as well as numerous articles. He founded PROG, Pro-Afrikaans Action Group, an NGO in South Africa in 2000, as well as a publishing company by the same name. He's currently president of Pretoria Pen, affiliated to the International Writers Organization. Dan Root has also been active in the movement for racial and linguistic equality in South Africa, and regularly protests against anti-minority violence in South Africa. According to Professor Jaap Stein and Heini van Koller of the Free State University in Bloemfontein, he has been one of the three most influential Afrikaans language activists of the 20th century. Our topic today is both on the dire situation in Europe with the ongoing invasion, and also how that parallels with the situation in South Africa, and how the established international media has mounted propaganda campaigns, both against the Europeans and against the Afrikaner, and built a wall of lies around us. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Dan Root. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You bet. Now, we have a lot to talk about, as there are dire straits, both for your country and mine as well, and Europe as a whole, really. There are so many things I do want to ask you about. And, of course, you've been an activist concerning the rights of your people, a minority in South Africa. But, you know, before we dive into some of the main meat, if you will, of our conversation, for our audience who might not be familiar with you, Dan, just briefly tell us about yourself when you founded PROG, you know, your website, and how you came to write about the crisis in South Africa from the angle that you do.
Well, yes, I grew up here in South Africa. I was born here, and then I, you know, went to an Afrikaans high school, and then I went to a fairly left-wing English university, and that was a fairly confusing time, I think, both in South Africa and for myself. And it was really when I spent some years in France, in Europe, that I got more of a perspective on our country. And but then I worked for a while in the banking and industry and the financial markets, and then I decided to get back more into writing and you know, reflecting on issues. It was sort of in the mid-90s and towards the late 90s. And then in 2000, we founded this Pro-Afrikaans Action Group, because even at that time, it was clear that this government was going to marginalize the Afrikaans language in South Africa. That was the first big issue that arose in the late 90s. And together with that, all of these affirmative action laws and so on gained momentum, and they were passed one after the other. So I think the two sort of went hand in hand, and currently there's again a major issue in South Africa around language and medium of instruction at university, and they're trying, you know, there are two universities left that are mainly Afrikaans. They are the University of Potchefstroom and the University of Stellenbosch down in the Cape. And this year and last year, there were sort of major media campaigns against them and all sorts of artificial incidents that have been created on those campuses so that the government can actually intervene and take control of these universities and point people that would kowtow to it going on. And this is more or less exactly what's happening. But, you know, increasingly after 2000, it became obvious to me that it's a much broader issue than just the kind of hostility that this government has towards the Afrikaans language. And that it's even a civilization, you know, it's a clash of civilizations, to put it that way.
Yeah.
Using Huntington's term. And they're really trying to socially engineer us into something completely different, the so-called Africanization, and, you know, and there's extreme hostility towards anything Western or European. And the term, the term Eurocentric in South Africa is like a swear word. Anything that's Eurocentric is bad. And the entire history of the West, of Western civilization and European civilization is just a great big negative. You know, you're not supposed to admire it at all or even know anything about it. And literally today, in very many of these university courses, you can do a course in English literature and never encounter, you know, the English Romantic poets or Charles Dickens or Jane Austen or Joseph Conrad or James Joyce or any of those people. You'll just be studying Black African literature as English literature.
Hmm.
That's the way it works these days in South Africa.
So no special protection for you as a minority, as we see in other countries founded by Europeans? Well, tell us a bit about the situation. Paint a picture for audience who might be unfamiliar with this.
Are you talking about the language issue specifically, or about the Western minority in South Africa?
Yeah, the latter. I mean, I know it's a big question in itself, and there's so many different tangents to it, but give us an overview, if you like, of what it is like.
Well, you know, the Western minority in this country, or the whites, to use that term, they've actually founded and developed this country over the last 350 years. We are as old as America. We're older than Australia or New Zealand. But after 1994, the notion was imposed that we are now more or less foreigners in our own country. We don't have any rights to anything, to our schools, universities, businesses, land, property, culture. You know, theoretically, there's a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, but somehow it doesn't apply to us because we belong to the wrong culture, the wrong race. And that's the sentiment you get all the time. You know, and even if you turn on the television and you look at the advertisements on TV, there are very few white people in the advertisements. They're all black, and they use typically African kind of situations, and there's a certain sort of African gaiety and nothing of the kind of European mentality in these advertisements. So you get the impression that you are a stranger in the land of your birth. That's a distinct impression that you get all the time. And of course, then we've got all these, we've got about 114 affirmative action laws that determine that, you know, you've got to have a black majority ownership in your business. Otherwise, you can't do business with the government or with other big companies. And there are so-called scorecards and lists and things that you have to comply with. And, you know, there's constantly this measurement of racial quotas. And even the national sports teams have to adhere to racial quotas. You know, if there are no, for example, the game of rugby is not very popular among blacks, but the rugby team also has to be black, even though there aren't very many black rugby players. So they force the national coach to actually include black players into the team, even though he may think that they shouldn't be there on merit. So everything is socially engineered, imposed, and increasingly we have less and less freedom as a country. And this is, you know, they go on about South Africa being a democracy, but it's in fact just a system of ethnic domination that we've got in this country. And, you know, if you compare us to the U.S., over there, the black minority has a lot of rights that whites don't, but it's not tied to the fact that they're a minority, it's simply tied to the fact that they belong to another race. And exactly the same holds in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
even though we are here a minority, and, you know, we have various issues with the government and, you know, problems that we've got. But they are still privileged over us just because they belong to, they're racially African. That gives them more rights than we have. And, you know, we see this tendency the world over. There's something special about Africans. They're talking about the African Renaissance, or the African, the rise of Africa. It's tied to mainly to the demographic rise of Africa towards the end of the century. There are going to be 2 billion Africans. And as I've explained, you know, in my article in American Renaissance on the website, the economy of sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, is extremely small. It's about the size, all of those countries together have an economy about the size of Belgium, where there are only 10 million people.
Hmm.
So it cannot possibly support 2 billion people on this continent. And inevitably, it's going to give rise to a massive migration towards the Northern Hemisphere, specifically Western Europe, but also North America.
You mean more than we're seeing now?
Yes. I mean, I think this is only the beginning of the whole movement. You know, as people, and also communicate, you know, modern communications and technology are actually favoring this migratory movement as it puts people into contact with those countries abroad, and a lot of the first wave of Africans that are already in those countries, they maintain connections, of course, with their countries of origin and their extended family and so on, and they are moving. I've heard that in Toronto, of course, in Canada, there's a sizable Nigerian community. People from the DRC, of course, from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, are moving to France and to Belgium and other French-speaking countries in Europe. So, yes, we are at the start of a massive change in the world, a demographic change. And, you know, we believe here in South Africa that what we are experiencing at the moment is simply what the rest of the world will be living through in 20 or 30 years' time.
Right, exactly. Do you think those countries will be able to keep up with the economic production as populations are, largely replaced in European countries? Are these economic engines just going to keep going and functioning as they are now, do you think?
No, I don't think so, because, you know, our experience here in South Africa is that, you know, typically Africans, they are politically very effective in that they function as a group, as, you know, they're very much consensus-seeking. I mean, that's part of African culture, that there should be harmony between people and within political parties and nations and so on, even though Africa, of course, is prone to civil war and ethnic conflict, they're always striving for this kind of harmony system. And in politics, that works very well, and it has worked well for them in this country too. And there are certain issues around which they perfectly agree, and especially when it comes to their views on Europeans and Western culture and so on, and their general hostility towards that culture. So I think if they're politically effective, but economically they are very poor. Productivity all over Africa is extremely low. Unless people get told to work, they don't generally do it by themselves. It's a very complex issue that might have to do with the fact that Africa is a warm continent. The tropics are generally, it's very easy to live there because you don't have to deal with Swedish winters or North
right.
European winters. And you can simply live off the environment. And that's what Africans have been doing for hundreds of years. And now what's happening in South Africa is that they are actually living off the accumulated capital of the system, of the white system that we have developed over the last 350 years. And various institutions have been completely bankrupted by the new management that sort of come in, and within the first few years they would spend the accumulated reserves and working capital of the company or the state enterprise. And I can name at least all the major public enterprises in South Africa, like the railways, the post office, the state television and radio, the municipalities and so on. They've all been completely ransacked, and you just have these people coming in who spend money, pay themselves high salaries, and that they don't produce anything. There's no development or adaptation to a changing environment. They're simply there to live off the available resources, and once that's finished, there's a crisis, and then the central government has to bail them out. We've also seen it with South African Airways, that used to be one of the most well-run airlines in the world. It was quite conservative in its financial affairs. The people who ran it didn't earn big salaries. They were simply quasi-civil servants who managed the airline on behalf of the country.
Right.
And now it's had various bailouts in succession, losing billions every year. And you've also had affirmative action there, and the board. Recently, the board resigned, and there was infighting between the members of the board. And it's just a complete shambles. So I think, once Africans acquire more and more power in the world, that this is what we will see, that they will be consuming resources as far as they go, and there will be very little, productive input by themselves.
Well, tell us a bit how this came to be. I think our audience might be interested in knowing, how you guys ended up in this situation, and also then consequently how this might play out in ours, if we assume what you just, your prediction, if you will, comes true. Tell us about how the ANC came to power in 1994. Tell us a little bit about their ideology.
Well, I actually want to write a book one of these days about exactly that, how they came to power, because it seems to me that it hasn't been looked at in very great detail at all. But I think in a nutshell, South Africa is in its current state as a result of two things, you know, or two betrayals, as it were. It was first of all betrayed by the Western countries that while they actually rejected the Soviet system and East European socialism, I mean, they actually embraced the South African Communist Party that was the moving force behind the ANC, because in 1968 the ANC was just about a moribund organization and just being kept alive by the South African Communist Party at that time still being funded by the Soviet Union and would later then be funded by the Nordic countries. And from those very early beginnings and the support of the Western media, they managed to take control of the entire country. I mean, it was the most surprising thing ever. And so the first betrayal was by the Western countries, Western journalists, who simply wrote us off, even though we fought in the two world wars and the Allied side and in Korea as well. I think Ronald Reagan also referred to that. Both Ronald Reagan and I think Charles de Gaulle were very much conscious of the fact that South Africa was part of a Western group of nations.
But right.
The Western journalists and some of the Western leaders simply wrote us off, betrayed us, and then our own people, our own so-called leaders, towards the end, they simply capitulated. You know, during these so-called negotiations, I mean, there were a few tense moments in the beginning when the ANC wanted everything. They wanted all power, economic, military, political, economic, and so on. And our leaders, you know, the few who took a fairly, strong stance during the negotiations, they were simply cast aside and they were replaced by yes men,
mm-hmm.
who eventually acceded to everything. And we were sort of just presented with a fait accompli in 1994, that from now on we were second-class citizens. And my fear is that the same, I mean, we've seen this kind of pattern in recent Western history ever since the Second World War.
Yes.
If you look at what happened in Algeria, how the French government actually betrayed the PNR in Algeria, and a million of them simply had to leave within a month, during and after the civil war in Algeria, we see a consistent pattern of that, and the Western elites will eventually betray their own populations, and we're also seeing it during this great immigration debate that's raging in both Europe and in North America, that in a consistent way, constantly, the Western elites actually choose the immigrants over their own people.
They're
more concerned about the future of the immigrants and about the Third World wanting to move to their countries than about their own citizens and their future and their future development and evolution as nations with very proud and long-standing histories.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Yes, that's something that actually should be analyzed by someone. In the early 20th century, you had people like Spengler and Toynbee and so on writing about the decline of the West. And at that time, I think it was more of an idea than a reality. They were just seeing these signs, perhaps, of a decline and kind of a fatigue setting in certain Western countries. Spengler probably saw it in Germany during and after the First World War. And I think Toynbee was also starting to see the eventual collapse of the British Empire, which would, for him, probably represent something of a decline. But now we are really living through an era where there's a demographic problem all over Europe and in North America. We've got economic problems and, you know, there's this decadence, kind of classical decadence all over, where you know, things like feminism and coupled with the decline of the family, and also a kind of, yeah, you could also call it a sexual perversion.
Right, yeah.
All these gay movements, pornography. You know, I'm not much of a prudish person myself, but, and I've never been in favor of censorship and so on, but I think in very many Western countries now, you can see that it reminds one of, you know, the worst years of the Roman Empire.
You know, yeah.
Some of the classical civilizations where people were more interested in their own pleasure and pursuing all sorts of perverse ideals instead of, you know, what's good for society and what's conducive to a future for our children.
Well, exactly. And it's also how those movements are being used politically to destroy those groups who are not protected under the same, you know, rules and laws. I think we've seen this not only with the the uprooting of the statues of Cecil Rhodes and the likes in South Africa, but in the same way as have been done in America towards, Confederacy generals and things like this, that we're seeing a whole, an uprooting of the culture that has been in place, literally turning over the statues of those people who founded the country. And that's what annoying me in the situation, that it's not about equal rights for all and tolerant, is about using that specially protected group to destroy the other groups that are not protected.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's part of this neo-Marxist cultural revolution, which has stigmatized the whole of Western history from the beginning until maybe about 1990 or so. And everything that took place before is supposed to be colonialist, racist, white supremacist, and so on.
Yeah.
And only the very recent so-called multicultural history, that's the only thing that we can attach value to, as well as to Afrocentrism and these other accounts of history that accord, you know, central role to the non-Western peoples and specifically to Africa. Asia, to some extent, I suppose, too, but the focus is really on Africa as being the cradle of civilization. They are even using that term. And, you know, as you probably know, there have been various radical authors in the US and elsewhere that have claimed that Western culture was really stolen from Africa.
Right, exactly.
By Martin Bernal, the Black Athena, and so on. So even though, Black Athena might be a marginal kind of text in the greater scheme of things, but that somehow, unconsciously, that idea has already set in. And therefore, you know, all the statues and all the artworks, all the literature from prior to plus minus 1990 is supposed to be worthless. In some academic departments, I suppose they are still studying it, but the way things are going now, it won't be very long before all of those will be replaced and then the statues will be torn down, maybe even some of the paintings. If they were not worth so much money, they would also have been defaced by now.
Yeah, I believe you're right. Now, let me ask you about what you think about if there's a larger kind of you mentioned the Western elites, and they're certainly part of this. They're part of seeking to eradicate their own culture, replacing the people within it and whatnot. But there has to be, for this to be successful that you talk about, there has to be more to it than that, because as an economic force, they're not there in the same way that, say, colonial powers were. And as an organizational force beyond the politics you mentioned, that isn't really there either. So is someone helping to organize this and orchestrate this and creating movements? What do you see as the force behind this, Dan?
Yes, I think there are definitely groups out there in the world today that are working towards the downfall of the West. And, again, they are these left-wing neo-Marxist groups. And there's certainly, I've been following some of the debates around the role, the so-called Jewish question, which was sometime in the early 20th century on everyone's lips. And I must say, if you're honest, in South Africa, the people who organized the urban terrorism and so on, they were all Jews. And
right.
In the U.S. as well, the people who are in the forefront of some of these very negative and destructive social movements, people like Saul Alinsky and so on, they're all Jews. They all came from a certain part of Eastern Europe, from Lithuania, Poland, and areas like that. I recently read quite a bit of material on South African history towards the end of the 19th century, when about 100,000 Lithuanian Jews came to South Africa in the 1890s and early 1900s. And they've been a small group of radical, a small group of radical Jews have played a key role in bringing this whole revolution about. And it's not me saying that, they're actually saying it themselves. There's even last year, one of them actually published a book about this and called it The New Radicals. So they saw themselves as the new radicals, and they were in the forefront of this movement. And somebody like Joe Slovo, who was actually born in Lithuania, he played a key role in keeping the revolutionary movement on track and getting the ANC in tow and keeping the ANC alive so that they could eventually take power in South Africa.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's quite ironic because the West has adopted the religious symbols of Israel and the Old Testament, New Testament, and so on. But at the same time, something from that tradition seems to be gnawing away at the very foundations of this entire civilization. So it's almost as if it has been founded on clay and not on rock.
Right.
And that's one of the big, I think that's one of the big intellectual and ideological problems that we'll have to address if we are going to survive. And time and again, I watch quite a bit of stuff from France on the internet and so on. And there was a few weeks ago, there was an incident where some people in an area of Paris, they were actually collecting money for these migrants coming into their country illegally and squatting there on the street and even, providing medical care for them and buying food and medicine for them and so on. And it's this, the altruism that is at the root of Christianity which seems almost like a lethal weakness of European people the world over.
Right.
In the sense that they are always the first to pity others, but they don't pity themselves, and they love the other, but not themselves. You know, and it seems to me to be it's a kind of psychological pathology that we all suffer from. I think all of us are, to some extent, influenced by that through our upbringing and early childhood experiences and so on. And if we are going to make a stand today, we will have to overcome that. I don't know if you've read that. There's quite a famous novel by a Frenchman called Jean Raspail, which was translated into English also in the 1970s when it was published. The Camp of the Saints,
which is
called in English.
Yeah,
I think it sold quite a lot of, maybe a couple of million copies in the US as well. And that book was translated into Afrikaans too in South Africa in about 1990. And some people thought that this would, in this country, it would give people some sense of the impending kind of invasion that we are going to suffer in this country, but somehow it didn't have much of an effect here, maybe just on a few people. But that to my mind, is a prophetic novel, because what's happening at the moment in Europe is exactly what happens in the novel, when these ships come into the Mediterranean and they start going ashore in southern Europe, and from there the third world people spread throughout Western Europe to invade the territory peacefully without firing a shot. And there's an incident towards the end of the novel where the French president has to tell his army and police to actually fire on these unarmed, pathetic invaders, and the people in uniform don't have the heart to fire on unarmed people, and that is the signal then for the entire takeover of Western Europe.
Wow.
So I think we need to reread that novel by Raspail and really think about it, because, you know, you're seeing it now in Germany, where the public sympathy is now turning towards actually welcoming these people coming into their country and actually, to some extent, place their fate above the fate of Germany or their own king.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's address the problem here, because obviously, you know, people don't see it that way, and that's the problem. People don't see that. Yes, they're seeing this, as you say, as an altruistic move to be able to help other people, to make sure that, you know, that they are safe. It makes them feel good. It makes them feel like they're doing something that's worthwhile, something real, and et cetera. But the disconnection here is that there's not only elitist plans to replace the populations of Europe. There are people openly talking about this, including the political leadership. Most people are not aware of this, of course, but the fact remains that how do you think you can communicate something like that to these people who are altruistic and who are not seeing that in the long term, this will mean the replacement of their own population. In the long term, this will mean that they will become a minority in their own countries, etc. There has to be an awakening occurring there at some stage, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think we need a vast intellectual movement around this, and people need to be writing books about it. They need to make films about it. There has to be a lot of discussion around this. And that's the only way to make the broader population aware of what's coming. If we don't manage to do that, it's going to be the end, because then eventually, you know, Western Europe and North America will look like South Africa. It will be a few pockets of, organized Western life surrounded by shanty towns, crime and grime and increasing corruption, and a breakdown of the system at all levels. Eventually, even technology will start breaking down because, if you haven't got electricity, you can't keep your systems going.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been experiencing in South Africa, because for 20 years, first of all, in 1994, South Africa had a surplus production of electricity, and there were about 20,000 people working at the state utility company called Eskom. And now, 20 years later, the number of employees in that company has doubled, but the production of electricity has actually halved. So you could say that the productivity is about a quarter of what it was before. Over the last 2 years or so, we've had these constant blackouts and problems with electricity, and price of electricity going through the roof. We now spend as much on electricity as on food. It costs you the same amount of money. So something of that order will also be happening elsewhere in the world once degradation sets in.
One thing, and you're absolutely right, I mean, there's a lot of elements of worry here. Who's going to be running the nuclear power plants at the end of all this? But one thing that I've been surprised by is the hostility of many of the incoming people as well. We linked up a story today, for example, about people making threats of decapitation right on live TV. This took place in Budapest, was just a couple of days ago, I think. But this is just one example, of course, but there's been many other kinds of scenarios like this. We saw when people crossing over the border from Macedonia into Greece, there were, violence against the police. There were shouting F you to them and things like this. There's been violent attacks against local populations. In Sweden, we've had not only an increase in violent crimes and whatnot, but there have been even riots over, for example, what food is being served at certain, asylum housing facilities, etc. There's a lot of this kind of things that are starting to happen. And I've been very surprised by that in terms of where the gratitude is for the local population that are taking these people in. I have not seen much of that, to be honest. Have you?
No, not at all. I was once given a very unfair interview by some American TV channel where they actually edited it afterwards in such a way that they made me say the opposite of what I actually said. I mean, they would literally take a yes or a no from various parts of the recording and then insert it randomly at certain points to make it look as if to fit their agenda. And one of the questions they actually asked me was, do you think black South Africans have shown gratitude to whites for funding their education and health systems for so long, over many decades, and doing so much for their education, and giving them bursaries and so on? And I said, no, I can't recall a single incident where any black leader expressed gratitude for that. They just think that they're entitled to it and they're not receiving enough. That's the gist of it.
Yeah.
And the same goes for all these immigrants who are now streaming into the Western countries. No matter how much will be done for them, how many grants and payments and allocations and so on they'll receive, they will never be grateful for it, number one, and number two, they will never get enough of it. There will always be a sense that they are entitled to more from where they came from.
Right.
And
yeah.
Yeah, I think it's something extraordinary. Not in their own communities. I mean, they treat each other in their own cultures in a very crude and what you want to call.
Well, it's more, isn't it a bit more kind of tribal? It's based on the family a bit more. Many countries have not developed the type of commons, that Western European countries have done with a social security system, with a vast healthcare system. I mean, sure, there's differences between, Northern Europe and Eastern Europe, but, there's an inclination of something that is heading in the right direction. But in other cases, that's not, in the case of other countries, that's just not the case. And it seems to be a little bit more everyone kind of fends for themselves. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Yes, you're probably right. But what I was thinking was that within these, call them non-Western cultures, often there is a far greater sense of social distance. You know, like the chief is always on a much higher level than one of his subjects. And they are very much used to that inequality that pertains between the members of their own people and their own clans and tribes and so on. And when they come to the West, ironically, they insist on equality with the indigenous Europeans and North Americans, citizens of those countries. But they are very used to being treated in a very unequal way, and often in a very cruel way by their own people in power. And if you see in Africa how African leaders treat their own people, it's absolutely abominable.
So are they kind of sick and fed up with that, and that's one of the reasons why they want to come to Western and European nations, do you think? Because they know to a certain extent that's what's being offered in those countries, and they see that as an opportunity to get out of their system and into something new where they can not only benefit from it, but, get something for nothing, basically.
Yes. Well, the something for nothing is what motivates them, definitely. Because they, you also find, especially in Africa, that there's a problem with causality and with causal reasoning. For example, if you've got a businessman or an industrialist who built up a whole empire through hard work, or maybe invented something, patented it, and generated some wealth from that, they won't see the cause between his wealth and his work and intellectual achievements. They will simply see it as pocket of wealth that's there and that needs to be shared with others. And they don't see any connection between their own poverty and some of their own social problems, and high birth rates, the fact that their schools are completely disorganized and dysfunctional, that their own teachers are actually not teaching. And they don't blame them for their conditions.
They see
this as an unfortunate, that they've been dealt a bad hand, that fate or has given them
they were born in the wrong place or something.
Exactly. Yeah, they were born in the wrong place, and therefore they now need to go to the good place.
Exactly. And at the same time, of course, we have a left-wing mainstream programming of these people. I mean, I don't know how much they, are these people online? Do they have a cell phone where they're at? Do they read international news, etc.? But my point is that they seem also to be getting the kind of a mainstream left-wing programming, which is that, all the faults in the world are Europeans. The white man is the reason why you've been dealt this hand at the same time, right? So there's a guilt trip. It's almost like by them you know, going to the West and taking advantage of the system, that act in itself is a form of equalization for the oppressive history of the white man, right?
Yes, exactly. Now, you're really spot on. And in this country, in South Africa, of course, it's in an even more extreme form, because here they've latched onto this word apartheid, you know, which actually ceased to be used even in the 1960s. But it sort of kept on, they kept it alive, and they built it up into this concept of white supremacy and the selfishness of the white man and his racism and so on. And in South Africa today, everything is blamed on apartheid.
Yes.
If there's say at the end of the year, the school leaving exams, there's a lot of cheating going on in some remote province, then that would, and then eventually also a lot of these school children would fail, that would be blamed on apartheid. Everything would be blamed on apartheid. You have an influx of 5 million Zimbabweans who settle around our cities in shanty towns, and they, you know, as a result of the economic failures of Zimbabwe under its dictator Robert Mugabe. But those conditions of poverty and would also be blamed on apartheid. So everything gets blamed on apartheid. And I think this kind of simplistic logic of blaming whites and Westerners for all the problems in the world, that will eventually reach the same kind of absurd level as it has already reached in South Africa, also elsewhere in the world, in Europe and in North America.
And what do you think will be the consequent action to that? Will there be a, you know, legislation? Will there be maybe violent uprising? What do you think will happen?
Well, you know, one of the things that we fairly used to in South Africa are riots. I mean, in America, every now and again, there's a riot and a lot of publicity around it, but on any given day in South Africa, there's a riot somewhere. Some of it doesn't even get into the news. So-called protests, there are about 10 to 15 protests every day, and at least one of them would degenerate into public violence, looting, theft, storming liquor stores, and that sort of thing. So at a certain point in Western Europe, I can only see that the same phenomenon will manifest itself, and there will be random violence and looting and rioting going on all the time. And I can only, you could perhaps compare it to the outbreak of Ebola in Western Africa. In West Africa, you know, when it first occurred about 2 years ago, it was headlines every day. But it's still going on there. There's still a certain amount of infections spreading and so on. But it's no longer in the news. So the same goes for rioting. You know, initially, there's an initial shock around it. In this country in 1976, when we had those huge riots in Soweto, which were then also blamed on government policies and apartheid and so on. Even though they were looting liquor stores and beer halls and burning down schools, that made huge headlines around the world. But now it no longer does, because it's now become almost a condition of violence and disorder that we are living in. And you know, the same will take place elsewhere in the world, the way I see it, because once these populations who are used to this level of social violence and disorder, once they settle in those countries, they will bring that culture with them.
Right, exactly. Now, we have much more to discuss here, Dan. I can't believe we just about 50 minutes have flown by here already. We're going to take a break in a few minutes, and then we're going to pick up in the second. I have much more to ask you about, and we're really just kind of getting started with the conversation here. But let's just talk about your website a bit and some of the things that you have available for people who want to read more about your work. I know that you're the author of the Scourge of the ANC, but I think you have a couple of other titles out there as well. Give us those and tell us more about the website.
Yes, well, we've got two websites, one in English and one in Afrikaans. The English one is at praag.org, praag.org, and the other one is at praag.co.za. And we publish a lot of commentary on both local and international issues on there, as well as news articles on topical issues and events around the world. And we're particularly interested in this decline of the West and all the ethnic problems that are manifesting themselves both in all over the world, but especially in North America, Europe, and, of course, in South Africa. So I think that every day there's some tidbit there that people might find interesting. I'm trying to, at the moment, I'm not getting enough time to write internet articles, although I try to write at least one piece every week. I try and express myself on a lot of these issues a lot of the time, and even for those people who might not be able to read Afrikaans, you can use Google Translate to translate some of the stuff that we publish on our Afrikaans site as well, which actually has a bit more material at the moment than the English site, although each one of those is updated every day with several pieces, so there's always something to read there. Regarding my book publications, there's Scourge of the ANC, and I also wrote a piece about South Africa's identity and the weird way in which, a lot of blacks have also adopted the English identity in South Africa, and also the role of some of our Lithuanian immigrants in their kind of adoption of a certain kind of imperial English identity, and I called that little essay Raiders of the Lost Empire, and that's published earlier this year. And I refer to George Orwell quite a bit in that book and some of the things he wrote about England. And ultimately, even though, in this country there's been an ongoing conflict between, ever since the two Anglo-Boer Wars of the 19th century, and which also explains some of the divisions and conflicts in South Africa, because to some extent members of the English elite and also the Johannesburg Jews have actually seen in the black population their main their main ally in toppling the entire system in South Africa, and it's more or less how it has played out. And ironically, the bulk of the English-speaking population has actually sided mostly with the Afrikaner governments of the past. So it's not as if the average Englishman or English speaker out there recognizes himself in this, but they have, through their sort of adoption of a kind of quasi-imperial globalist identity, they've also managed to, effect this huge revolution in South Africa that is so inimical to any form of Western or European identity. And I write about that in the book on Raiders of the Lost Empire.
All right, very good. We'll have the links up on the website, of course, and we'll link up to some of the books that you have available as well. There's a lot of material on the website, folks, so do check it out. Regularly updated news. I check the English version regularly, but just as Dan said, you can also, of course, just use Google Translate to check in on the Afrikaans side as well. Okay, well, we'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, Dan, and we'll be right back with more after this. A second hour coming up at redicemembers.com. When you want to hear the continuation of this radio program, get access to both hours, all shows, archive shows, and all our video material, please subscribe and keep 100% independent media alternative commercial free and help us to expand in our coverage as well. Redicemembers.com is the website. Go there. You can browse our archives. You don't have to be a member for that. We have over 1,000 radio shows and also a growing archive of video material as well. With Dan Root, we continue to talk about the contrived migration crisis and the seeming powerlessness of the various European nations. We talk about how to keep people out and also put responsibility on the Gulf states, like Saudi Arabia, but also on Israel, Egypt, Lebanon, and other Middle Eastern countries as well, to make sure that people that are trying to cross the Mediterranean, ultimately putting their own families in danger, are able to stay close to where they are instead of pinning the responsibility on Europeans somehow for their stupid mistakes. We have much more to discuss with Dan Root on how the Camp of the Saints is coming true. We have more upcoming on Red Eyes Radio as well, of course. Kim Dortch joins us with the attorney Melody Kramer for an update on the Dortch case in Murrieta, Riverside County in California. Do you remember that horror story? Well, we have an update for you on that, and I'm sad to say that it's gotten a whole lot worse as well, so much more is coming up with that. We also have Daniel Friberg from Arctos and Mootpool.nu. Then we have a special with Kevin MacDonald, Tim Murdoch, and John Friend on the invasion of Europe as well. But right now, stay tuned for Hour 2 with Dan Root. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back.